Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin here in the second hour of the program. Some audio open lines for the next half hour. Then we're going to be talking with Dr. Peter Jones about spirituality and sexuality. He says God and sex go together, but not the way the pagan or the paganized culture seems to think they do today. We'll talk more about that in a half hour here on Issues Etc. It's audio open lines or call-in numbers 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. You can email us right here in the studio with a question or a comment. issuesetc@kfuo.org. We are coming to you live this Thursday, the 14th of September. Well, according to Rich Lowry, who's editor of National Review, President Bush, who met with some conservative journalists on Tuesday, senses that a religious revival might be in the offing for America, maybe even America's third Great Awakening. There was a first Great Awakening, a second Great Awakening, and apparently the president is sensing perhaps a third one on the horizon for America. Let's hear from Rich Lowry of National Review.
It feels to him as though there is an uptick in religiosity out there that possibly might qualify as the third awakening, but he left it to the journalists in the room to investigate this further and see whether there's any merit in the idea, but it's clearly something he's been thinking about.
All right, I remember it well. I really do. I remember it well. I think it had to be now going on 6 years ago when President George W. Bush was first elected. And we were talking about, what do you think of this? He's a professing Christian. He had made some statements in the campaign leading up to his first election about Jesus being his favorite political philosopher. I think that's the way the question was put to him. And we'd asked you in open lines, what do you think about the election of President Bush, a professed Christian, to the White House? And what do you think it'll mean? And we had several callers who said, we are on the cusp of an awakening, of a revival. He will be a godly man of prayer, and if he proves to be, it will signal a religious revival in this country. Now, 6 years later, the president is starting to sense something like that. This reporter, Lowry, is from National Review. He's the editor for National Review. National Review is not a liberal rag. If you've ever read it, it's a very conservative publication founded by William F. Buckley. So it's right in the mainstream of American conservatism. Lowry of National Review says that President Bush said he's seeing a religious stirring in America that could be a great awakening like the one before the American Revolution.
I believe the second was around the time just prior to the Civil War, and it was a religious revival that was associated with various social reform movements, including abolitionism.
What do you think about this? What do you think about the president sensing a religious revival? Do you agree with him? Do you disagree? 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Is this something that you want your president talking about? Whether or not your president believes that a religious revival is on the way, do you want him talking about it publicly? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Think about it. For those of you with a longer memory, think back to President Jimmy Carter. Remember, he was the one who talked about having a personal relationship with Jesus Christ. He was pretty much mainstream, left-of-center Southern Baptist, still is. What if he had talked about a religious revival? What if President Bill Clinton, also a member of the Southern Baptist Church, said he sensed a religious revival coming soon for America, maybe on the scale of even the first and second Great Awakening? How would you have reacted then? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's audio open lines. Email us here at issuesetc@kfuo.org. Now, Rich Lowry of National Review says President Bush noted that the people who greet him in the rope line when he goes and visits various venues tell him that they're praying for him. He knows they're praying for him.
He jokingly said, maybe it's just the only people praying for me in America are the ones who come to my event and shake my hand at a rope line. So, again, he wasn't making a big deal of this, but it's something that, you know, he's clearly thinking about.
Now, the president, I don't say if he's made a big deal about it, but he has mentioned many times, I can remember a handful of times, where President Bush has talked about the prayers of the American people, how he and Laura, his term is how he feels the prayers of the American people for him and supporting him. One of the reasons he believes there may be a religious revival on the way. Now, this is also the president, mind you, who celebrated the close of Ramadan with Muslims. This is also the president who considers the God of Islam and the God of Christianity to be one in the same. So if he hopes for a religious revival, one should probably wonder, even though he's a professed Christian, which religion will be revived? Because at least with respect to Islam, he doesn't see that much light between Christianity and Islam. Will it be a revival of American civil religion? You know, I might agree with the president there. I think evangelicals have done a lot to bring a religious revival to this nation in the last 20 years, but it hasn't been a religious revival of Christianity. It's been a revival of American civil religion. Heck, I saw a concert with on CMT, you know, the country music television network. Toby Keith, this big old strapping country western singer. And right around 9/11, he had a couple huge country hits because he reacted almost immediately to the terrorist attacks and to the American response to those terrorist attacks. And this guy, you should have seen, did you see this concert he gave? It was one of these unplugged concert by request, live by request. It was like he was a religious figure. And when he sang, what's the big hit he had? Oh my goodness. Courtesy of the Red, White, and Blue. You know what song I'm talking about. Where he's basically talking about how we're just going to go out there and just kick terrorist butt. Right? That's what he said. In a cruder way of saying it in his song. He said people had their eyes closed, their arms were in the air. You would have thought you were watching a religious revival. It was amazing. And I was watching him sing this and thought, well, that guy's pretty darn talented too. But the religion that has the Statue of Liberty as its centerpiece, or the American flag, or Uncle Sam, or Lady Liberty as its centerpiece, is not Christianity. That is American civil religion. It calls upon God to protect us from our enemies, but not the God of the Bible. So do you sense, like President Bush, that the country is on the cusp of a religious revival? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Email us here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Do you want your president making statements like this? Even if it's to the most conservative of all reporters at this meeting at the White House on Tuesday, he thinks maybe a third Great Awakening is on the way. Does he have any business talking about this? 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Finally, Rich Lowry, editor of National Review, says President Bush told him and the other journalists gathered there at the White House on Tuesday that cultures can change.
He got into this idea of the awakening by analogizing from the Middle East to our own culture. And he was pointing out, you know, our own culture has changed. It might take time, but it happens. And sometimes it can happen quite quickly. And something he pointed out was how the culture from the 50s to the 60s changed quite rapidly.
Well, now, I don't know what to make of this, because if you talk about the change from the 50s to the 60s culturally, one may argue, of course, that that was not a change for the better. Change is not always good. Sometimes change means, and shouldn't the baby boomers realize this in spades? Change is not always for the better. Sometimes it's for the worse. How have you changed from the time you were 25 until now when you're 50? Has your body changed for the better? I mean, maybe it has. Maybe you weighed 300 pounds when you were 25 and now you weigh 150. I don't know. But generally speaking, change in when it comes to our human bodies means deterioration, right? And it can be rapid or it can be slow. So from the 50s to the 60s, there certainly was a cultural change. A religious revival of sorts, no doubt about that. We're going to hear a little bit later in the program about the boomer spirituality, and there was a religious revival in the 60s. It was not a Christian religious revival, by the way. I want to hear from you on President Bush's remarks about the possibility of a third Great Awakening here in America. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. 2727 or issues etc at kfuo.org. Up first, Sharon calls from her car. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to make a comment about what President Bush said. Maybe he's not noted for being an intellectual, and you know, he's probably not an intellectual, theologically speaking. And, you know, he may not have it all together about, you know, the religions, really knowing what they believe, Islam versus Christianity, and who they consider God and that. But I think that in the last days, it does talk about in the Bible, that in the last days, that God would pour out his Holy Spirit upon all flesh. And I believe that there will be a spiritual awakening. Yes, there's going to be people that get off into false doctrine and cults. But at the same time, as we look in the Old Testament, Israel had spiritual leaders and rulers that took charge and created a revival. I think that he's doing the very best that he can with what he knows.
But given everything you said there, and mm-hmm. I'll respond to that here in a second, but is it President Bush's job, a la Old Testament leaders, to create the circumstances for a spiritual revival? Is that why we elected him?
Well, no. I mean, I don't think it hurts to announce that, but it's not the president's job to create that. It's not up to one person. He can make a declaration. And that's okay to make a declaration. And I don't see him really doing anything more than maybe making a declaration. It's really up to the churches in America to make that happen.
Sharon, thank you for the call. I want to deal with her call point for point here, if I could. Well, I don't think the president was making a declaration of a spiritual awakening. That probably would have made bigger news than just National Review or the AP or Issues, etc. If he would have said, "Today I declare a spiritual awakening is underway," that would be big news, believe me. Of course, we didn't elect him to do that. Now, she spoke at the beginning of his qualifications to make such a statement. She says he's not noted for being an intellectual. This is purely my private opinion, okay? So take it as nothing more than my private opinion, but I think the president is a heck of a lot smarter than people give him credit for. You don't get to a position he has gotten to without having some kind of smarts. I don't know if it's book smarts or school smarts, but he is a lot smarter than people give him credit for. Whether he's able to bring that across on camera or in his daily execution of his duties, I don't know. There are people out there who think I'm an idiot. And by comparison to some people, I really am. So whether he's qualified to make that statement, whether he knows all the history. Now, see, if a president's going to make a statement about a great awakening, he probably should understand the gravity of that kind of a statement, don't you think? Now, she says it does say in the Bible that in the last days, God will pour out his spirit on all flesh. Actually, if you look carefully, Sharon, at the passage, where that passage is interpreted, Acts chapter 2, the prophet Joel is the one who predicts this outpouring of the Spirit in the last days on all flesh. St. Peter very clearly says that prediction of Joel is being fulfilled there, that day, in the second chapter of Acts. He says, this is what the prophet Joel spoke about when he wrote, "In those latter days I will pour out my Spirit on all flesh." This. There is not necessarily a prediction from Joel that's supported by the Apostle Peter, that it's going to happen in these last days. It certainly happened in those last days. No doubt about that. And it doesn't say that the outpouring is going to happen as a second, third, or fourth great awakening in the United States. See, there's the danger always to somehow equate Old Testament Israel with 21st century America. That is a leap that is theologically impossible to make. It's rationally possible to make. 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727, our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, we heard from this young man sometime in the last few weeks. Al-Qaeda put out a tape. The second-in-command of Al-Qaeda had a few things to say, and then suddenly we heard an English-speaking voice, speaking flawless English, and the face was familiar to the CIA, to everyone who'd been watching Al-Qaeda and terrorism. The face was that of Al-Qaeda's American. Here's the story on this young man from CNN.
All the brothers who took part in the raids on America were dedicated, strong-willed, highly motivated individuals.
Azam the American, now an Al-Qaeda spokesman, used to be a long-haired California teenager. Today he is a mouthpiece for Osama bin Laden, predicting death and destruction for the country he grew up in.
Because today could be your last day.
His real name is Adam Gadan. He's delivered three recently released videotaped messages for Al-Qaeda. He speaks in perfect English, but occasionally slips into Arabic. Gadan, now 28 years old, grew up on this small goat farm in Southern California. As a teenager, according to family members, he was obsessed with heavy metal rock music until he stumbled across Islam at this Orange County mosque.
We were very pleased to see this young man coming to embrace Islam.
According to mosque leaders, Gadan, who was 17 when he signed this declaration accepting Islam, developed a passion for the religion. His family was happy at first because he had stopped listening to heavy metal. But then, according to mosque leaders, he started to change.
He started gathering with a group of men that I myself didn't feel very comfortable about them.
Those men, according to mosque members, had extreme Islamic views and were angry with the way the mosque was run. They watched Gadan develop that same anger until one day, they say it boiled over.
He came charging into my office that one day, screaming and yelling and angry, really angry. And he caught me off guard and he slapped me right across the face.
Gadan was arrested and ended up leaving the mosque. According to his family, he left California for Pakistan in 1998. Then, in 2004, his family would see this.
As a U.S. citizen who converted to Islam, was associated with Abu Zubaydah.
Adam Gadan was wanted for questioning by the FBI for possible ties to Al-Qaeda.
He is known to have performed translations for Al-Qaeda.
I was surprised because I really couldn't imagine that he would do anything that would get him in this position.
Since then, Gadan has been in several Al-Qaeda videos. In this one, released in July, he defends the practice of killing innocent Americans, saying international law doesn't apply.
No, thanks. We have our own law, the law of God, who says in his book,
because of his public role as an Al-Qaeda spokesman and the possibility he might be recognized, law enforcement officials say it's unlikely that Gadan would actually carry out an attack.
He is certainly supporting Al-Qaeda and is somebody whom we would very much like to arrest and prosecute.
Gadan's importance to Al-Qaeda seems evident. In a recent video, he's introduced by bin Laden's top deputy, Ayman al-Zawahiri, and still, it's Gadan that dominates the more than 45-minute message.
That we have no choice but to fight those who fight us.
Because he knows the United States and speaks perfect English, experts say Gadan is clearly a valuable asset for Al-Qaeda. What's unclear is why he turned against his country. Ted Rollins, CNN, Los Angeles.
So there's a little bit more on this fellow. I imagine we'll see more of him. It's interesting to me that it came, well, the statement that he made when the tape was released recently was a statement about conversion to Islam. He talked straight to us Americans in our language about, and to Westerners in general in English, about converting to Islam. I would call that proselytizing. Now, some people saw a veiled threat there in Al-Qaeda's American statement, but I don't know if there was a threat. It certainly was pretty bold proselytizing on part of this particular convert to Islam. It's audio open lines, 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. Our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. Well, six high-ranking bishops of the Episcopal Church USA began to meet in New York Monday this week. There are 2.4 million members in this American branch of the Anglican Church. They're dealing with all sorts of issues, including gay bishops, gay clergy, and sanctioning of same-sex marriages.
Several leading bishops of the Episcopal Church are in New York today to discuss a deepening rift over church doctrine and homosexuality. The disagreement has threatened to divide the church's nearly 2.5 million members. Some conservative dioceses have already distanced themselves from the American church, NPR's Rachel Martin reports.
Reverend John Yates and his congregation at the Falls Church in Virginia are embarking on a 40-day period of fasting and prayer. It's meant to help them decide whether to sever or loosen their ties with the mainstream Episcopal Church, a church they feel is moving in the wrong direction.
We feel torn. I myself don't see a really good alternative place for us to go to. It's not so much that I'm thinking about leaving the Episcopal family, but I do feel the Episcopal Church has left us.
That's the sentiment in dozens of congregations that are grappling with what they call a painful split in the church over gay rights, the role of women in the church, and what they see as an increasingly liberal interpretation of the Bible. Those divisions have been growing since 2003, when the National Church approved the appointment of Gene Robinson, an openly gay man in New Hampshire, as bishop. For some, the breaking point came this summer when the National Episcopal Convention elected its first female presiding bishop, Catherine Jeffords Shorey. She supports the appointment of gay and lesbian bishops. After that, seven dioceses voted to disassociate themselves from the American church, and instead they want to be put under the oversight of the global Anglican church. They haven't turned their back on the Episcopal church completely, but they are close. Jack Eicher is the bishop of the Fort Worth Diocese in Texas.
Well, I think that we may well be at that point where there are irreconcilable differences in theology and church discipline and so on. Then perhaps the best thing to do is say, how can we have an amicable divorce?
But Bishop Robinson and other leaders say keeping the church together is essential and possible.
There is room for all of us. I want all of those people in my church. The question is, do they want me in their church? Is this church going to be a church that cares more about purity and therefore wants to expel those who disagree on certain issues? Or is it going to be about the inclusive love of God?
Peter James Lee is the bishop of the Diocese of Virginia and will serve as the moderator for the meetings this week in New York. He says these talks are important because the debate isn't just about gay rights, but the founding principles of the church itself.
Historically, in the Episcopal Church, we've had individual congregations, individual dioceses that have had very different theological emphases and yet have been united in a common faith that puts Scripture at the center. I think those are the things that are now in some peril because our capacity to live with differences is being questioned.
The meeting will include both liberal and conservative bishops, and while they aren't expected to make any final decisions, Bishop Peter Lee says it's the first step in a critical conversation. Rachel Martin, NPR News, Washington.
What did I say yesterday about the difference, the real difference between liberal theologians and conservative theologians? Liberal theologians are more than willing to compromise everything, even their own convictions. Gene Robinson says, let's all stay together. Come on, I can live with the heterosexuals. The conservative theologians say we can't compromise our convictions. And they're the ones who are talking about breaking it all up. We'll be right back to talk to Peter Jones about God and sex.
The priesthood of all believers. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Historical theology is not just a bunch of names and dates and fact. It's the study of Christ being faithful to his promises.
Dr. Larry Rast of Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, on the importance of historical theology.
Historical theology is the study of theology over the course of time, just like the title says, theology over the course of time. But that can lead some to think that this is a dry, kind of an abstract endeavor, when in fact what we're talking about with historical theology is the faithful confession ongoing through the church by people that Christ has called, seeing him fulfill the promise that he will never leave the church orphaned or forsaken.
For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana, visit their website, www.ctsfw.edu.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Detmer. 8 states will weigh in on marriage amendments this November. While polls indicate wide support for the amendment defining marriage as being strictly between one man and one woman, the other side is making every effort to change the tide. Is the opposition gaining ground? Jessica Stallings takes a look at the latest polling.
If the ballots were cast today, Gary Bauer with American Values is confident all 8 states would vote in favor of a constitutional amendment defining marriage as between a man and a woman.
If the elections are fair and there's no distortions, we should do very well.
70% of registered voters in Tennessee favor the amendment, followed by 54% in Virginia. Jelaine Appling with the Family Research Institute of Wisconsin says her state touts 48% support.
We're building momentum. We're maintaining momentum. We're doing all of those things that have to be done. People in this state still, by majority, support marriage between one man and one woman.
52% support the amendment in Arizona and Colorado, while Idaho, South Carolina, and South Dakota await new polling numbers. In the meantime, Robert Geer with the South Dakota Family Policy Council says his state is getting hit hard.
The pro-gay side has really been fighting hard here in our state, shoveling all kinds of money in, because they know we're distracted by the abortion ban.
No matter what the polls may foretell, Mona Passignano with Focus on the Family Action says ultimately the call is to continue fighting.
What's going to be the key is that people don't get apathetic, that they show up and vote on November 7th for this marriage amendment. If they do that, we win every time.
To date, voters have approved marriage amendments in 20 out of 20 states by a crushing 70%. For Family News and Focus, I'm Jessica Stallings.
According to Bauer, just because the opposition launches extravagant campaigns to confuse voters, that doesn't mean they're gaining ground at the ballot box. For Family News and Focus, I'm Bob Detmer.
Friday's Midday Living Jubilee, live at 11:05 on AM 850 KFUO. Join me, Diane Summers. We'll be talking with Linda Anderson, co-author with Alan Anderson of Rescued, Saving Animals from Disaster, on those organizations and volunteers who rescued animals and reunited them with their owners after Hurricane Katrina. It begins at 11:05, Living Jubilee, on AM 850 KFUO.
Our Issues Etc. book of the month for September is actually a CD and a booklet. It's titled Listening to Luther. For more information, call Concordia Publishing House, 1-800-325-3040, or visit our website, issuesetc.org. The CD contains a recording of Luther's Small Catechism and hymns by Martin Luther. The booklet contains a history of the Small Catechism and several of Martin Luther's hymns, including the text. Listening to Luther, our Issues Etc. book of the month.
Look, I know Christians have the reputation of shying away from the subject of sex. I don't think that's true. Walk into a Christian bookstore sometime. At least lately, you will find an entire section devoted to marriage, love, romance, dating, and woven all through it, some books are explicitly about sex and Christianity's view of sex. But how good a job have Christians done of late in articulating a full-orbed Christian worldview regarding sex? We're going to answer that question first off here with, in this next hour of Issues Etc. with Dr. Peter Jones. I'm Todd Wilkin. Spirituality and sexuality is the subject for the next hour of Issues Etc. You can join us. Our call-in number 1-800-730-2727 and our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. So much of Christian writing on sex, to at least to my ear, sounds like a sanitized Harlequin romance. It's sad to say it does. Almost as though Christians are angels. Sexless, androgynous angels, and not men and women, the way we were created by God. Dr. Peter Jones is professor of New Testament at Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California. He's director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, and he's author of the new book called The God of Sex. Dr. Jones, welcome back.
Good to be with you, Todd.
Christians talk about homosexuality and gay marriage, and of late, even polygamy as it comes into the news. Do you think that Christians have done a good job of articulating the full-orbed Christian worldview regarding sex?
I don't think so. I think what we tend to do is cite Bible verses. When we come across perverted sex, we talk about people as lawbreakers. And some people even walk around with boards on their chest saying God hates fags. And, of course, that's the extremist one. But I don't think that we have seen the massive challenge that this new view of sexuality means to our Christian witness to the gospel, actually. It is, sexuality is a sort of fundamental and elemental expression of a totally different worldview that is challenging the very basis of Christianity to be able to speak truth.
You say near the end of your book, The God of Sex, that the nerve of Christians is being tested lately when it comes to sexuality. What do you mean by that?
Well, I mean by that that we have been put in a position in this culture that just a generation ago was considered Christian, where we can hardly open our mouths anymore and speak clearly what we believe. It's so totally socially incorrect, politically incorrect, to speak against the various perversions of sexuality in our day. And it really is a test of our nerve to see if we will be willing to be pushed to the margins for the sake of speaking truth. And I go around speaking at Christian colleges, actually also at secular universities, but I've been struck with how the secular university is silencing the Christian witness on campus. It's no longer really allowed to speak clearly its own full-orbed worldview. And, of course, right at the center of that is the teaching and beliefs of the Bible about sexuality.
One of the, and I think probably the central insight of your book, at least what I've taken away from it, Dr. Jones, is that God and sex are not only, they not only go together, they're inextricably linked. And if one has the proper God, then it follows, of course, that one will then have a proper understanding of human sexuality. And if one, a la Romans chapters 1 and 2, mm-hmm. has a different God, the wrong God, then one's view of human sexuality is going to go hand in hand in the wrong direction with that. Talk about that, if you would. Take us through those chapters of Romans and what Paul is saying there, connecting the slide toward paganism and idolatry mm-hmm. with the slide toward sexual immorality.
Yeah, in the first part of the book you mentioned, I give a large place to understanding Romans, especially Romans 1, with regard to the place of sexuality. Your listeners will remember that Paul eventually, in verse 26, in his description of ancient paganism, gets to a treatment of homosexuality and lesbianism, and it seems to fall out of the sky from nowhere. And I looked in past commentaries on Romans and various apologists of biblical orthodoxy, and it was interesting to see how they pretty much skipped that section. Now, I'm not criticizing them because, you know, in the past, that has not been a major problem for the church to face. But the interesting thing is, why does Paul get to that subject?
I mean, most people would say, Dr. Jones, he's simply, as you say, kind of pulling out of his hat the worst possible example of
exactly.
debauchery he could think of.
Yeah. You know, it's really odd that he gets there because, as you know, as a Lutheran, Romans is a book about the gospel. It's about law and gospel. It's the great epistle on soteriology. I find it intriguing that this great text on the meaning of justification and the work of God in redemption begins with a rather deep and intricate analysis of the pagan worldview. And that's how I read Romans 1, 18 through 32, as an analysis of the pagan worldview. And once you realize that, it has all kinds of implications. One is, I think Paul realized that he could not speak about the gospel in Rome without making sure that people understood the cosmology, that is, the worldview, against which soteriology, that is, the revelation about salvation, can make sense. In other words, we can talk about the gospel in our time, but if people have dropped the biblical worldview, they have no sense of a biblical cosmology, then the gospel will be meaningless to them. So here we have a wonderful example from the apostle himself. I'm still dancing around your question because it's such a profound one. Why does Paul deal with sex in Romans 1? Maybe I should stop for a minute. I'll carry on, but
okay.
You don't want a long essay.
Well, let's return to what I had mentioned before, and that is someone says, look, all Paul is doing is looking around the Roman world around, the pagan world around him. He's picking out what he thinks is typical of paganism. But I take it from a look at your book that Paul's attempting to do a little bit more than that. Mm. It's not that merely homosexuality is typical, that the two are not only accidentally connected, they are necessarily connected. The pagan worldview, the pagan gods, and a pagan sexuality.
That's right. Now, that's what one must see. And I checked today a book by June Singer called Androgyny, Towards a New Pagan Sexuality, Towards a New Sexuality. June Singer is a Jungian psychologist who became a Gnostic. And I had not discovered this book until recently. It was published in 1977. And she actually, in that book, says that androgyny, that is the mixing of male and female, is, and I quote her, the sacrament of monism. Now, that's very interesting to me because it shows that I'm not imposing my particular twisted views on what pagans believe. She, who is a thoroughgoing pagan, actually sees this clearly and says so. Paul comes to homosexuality and lesbianism because that is the sacrament, the sexual sacrament, if you will, of paganism. I know I need to back up and identify all these words. Paganism, what's that? Paganism is the worship of the earth, paganus from Latin, of the earth, or associated with the land, and it comes to mean, in spiritual terms, the worship of the earth. So today we can hear about neo-pagans and Wiccans and Druids and those kinds of people. But generally speaking, paganism is the worship of the earth. Paul is actually describing that. I find the most luminous verse almost in the entire Bible for today's world and the issues we're talking about now is in that very chapter of Romans, Romans 1:25, where Paul says, they exchanged the truth of God for the lie and worshipped and served the creation rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Don't you see that that is setting up in a face-to-face opposition, two kinds of spirituality, the worship of the Creator and the worship of the creation. So right in the center of that chapter, you have this amazing condensed statement of two worldviews. And I do believe, I've come to believe this more and more, that you really cannot get any further, you cannot go deeper to any lower bedrock of the two ways of being spiritual or religious than what Paul says in Romans 1:25.
How would you respond to someone who says if homosexuality is for Paul, this perverted sexuality is for Paul, the sacrament of pagan spirituality? How would you respond to someone who says, but not every active homosexual is consciously a pagan? In fact, one might even argue that very few, especially in the United States, would consciously associate themselves with anything remotely resembling paganism.
Right. I'm not suggesting that all homosexuals understand this. There are lots that do, by the way. And you remember, I forget what chapter is in the book, but I did some research on homosexuality, androgyny. I think that they are forms of the same thing. And it was very interesting to discover that throughout time and space, the shaman in pagan cults is a homosexual. I don't think that that is accidental. The reason why, of course, is because you have these pagan groups in, you know, Borneo and in the Amazon, in Africa, in the Arctic, in North American Indian animism, in Indian Hinduism, and you can go on and on and on, who obviously had no contact, and yet the ideal figure in that pagan cultus is the homosexual. And many scholars of religion have noted this, and indeed the leading homosexuals who consider themselves spiritual actually celebrate it. So you're right, lots of people who fall into homosexuality for all kinds of reasons don't see it. But my point that I would want to make to them is that sooner or later that they will find themselves more and more drawn to a religion that they never thought they would adopt because it is so endemic to that view. I don't know whether that answered your question, Todd.
Well, yes, I guess, and it raises another one, Dr. Jones, and that is, here we stand, at least in America, at this particular point in history, where I can name at least three, perhaps four, maybe five mainline Protestant denominations: the Episcopal Church USA, the Presbyterian Church USA, the Methodist, the United Methodist Church, and probably the United Church of Christ. Those are the big ones that. Oh, and the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the largest Lutheran church body in the United States, that either at the practical level or at the policy level are openly flirting with the ideas of gay marriage, gay clergy, gay bishops, all along those lines. If the two go together, pagan sexuality, pagan spirituality, they are introducing paganism into, however it comes, they are introducing paganism into these allegedly Christian denominations.
You're dead right, and they don't see it. They have failed to see in the denial of all, well, many of the essential notions of biblical orthodoxy that slowly but surely they lead themselves to another kind of spirituality. I think especially Frank Griswold's sermon that he preached at the ordination of Gene Robinson, the homosexual bishop of New Hampshire. And he never quoted the Bible. He quoted Rumi, the Muslim, that mystical sect of Muslims. This word has gone out of my mind. Who really is a pagan, and he said, we will, this is Frank Griswold's sermon, we will meet together in the field beyond us where there is neither good nor evil. Sufis, that's right, the Sufi poet Rumi. And that is such an essentially pagan notion. You know, you can dress up your language with all kinds of Christian terminology, But the idea that we all meet together beyond good and evil is so profoundly pagan, though I'm sure Frank Griswold would deny it, that indeed we are going headlong into a situation in mainline churches that are essentially, functionally, buying into paganism. You see, that was the essence of Gnosticism in the ancient world. Gnosticism was the introduction of paganism into the church, but dressed up in Christian dress. And that's what we're doing today. I was actually doing research this morning on Carl Jung, who was taught, is taught at many theological seminaries. Jung was a radical pagan, and he is taught in many mainline seminaries as the one who truly understands human psychology and spirituality. And you would not believe how pagan Jung is. But that's a totally different subject. But you do raise the issue of where mainline Christianity is going. And I would say it's going right into a new form of Gnosticism, paganism. And their position on homosexuality only confirms that direction.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Jones, professor of New Testament at Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California, director of Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, and author of the new book, The God of Sex, about spirituality and sexuality, during this hour on Issues Etc. A few more minutes before this break, and plenty of time to call either before or after this break, 1-800-730-2727. Call with a question or a comment, 1-800-730-2727, or you can email us with that question or comment right here in the studio, issuesetc@kfuo.org. You had written near the middle of your book about an observation that St. Augustine had made in the 5th century A.D., so very long ago, about these sexual priests, homosexual priests called the Galoi. He wrote, in the presence of an immense throng of spectators and listeners of both sexes, they were well known for their cross-dressing, outrageous makeup, flamboyant hairstyles, ritualistic, ecstatic dancing, characteristic mannerisms, and the gift of prophecy. I could not help but think, last summer, the United Church of Christ, this gigantic Protestant denomination, had its annual gathering under their new logo, which is a Mother Earth, kind of cradling all of humanity. They had I don't know if you read about this in news. We talked about it on the program. They had a choir of various genders, and here we mean not just men and women, but transgendered, cross-gendered. They all started out in choir robes that didn't indicate any gender, and as they sang traditional Christian hymns, they disrobed, revealing various forms of cross-dressing, kind of forcing the mixed gender idea. This was at their national convention. I just thought to myself, as you observe here, there is really nothing that has changed from Augustine's day.
No, and that was, you know, what I was writing about Augustine in the context of showing these various pagan cults with the androgynous priests, and in particular the goddess Artemis, Diana, Cybele, that's the three names she has. But you can go back into the mists of time and find it, and you can find it all over the world. So what Augustine was seeing was exactly, you see, a repeat of all that. And now, as you mentioned, I missed that. I don't know how I missed that. It's so colorful, so clear. It's amazing, that example you gave of what is happening. And, of course, you see there, don't you, how much theological liberalism is tied to sexual perversion.
So if the goal of pagan spirituality when it comes to sexuality is to blur and destroy and deconstruct the differences between male and female and all the things that go along with it, that created order, then talk about the origin of a proper Christian understanding of sexuality in, first of all, recognizing the difference. We've got a couple of minutes here before this break, Dr. Jones.
Well, you know, if I might push that question over to the next section, simply to finish answering your first question about Romans, because I didn't quite get to it. And let me do that, Todd. Because Paul is expecting us to do exactly what you've just said, but he does so by getting us to think about what pagans do with God. And you remember he says that they suppress the truth about God, the Creator. So the essential move, first of all, is to reject the notion of the Creator. That's the essence of paganism. And then in verse 25, you remember I cited, it's the worship not of the Creator, but of creation. So Paul tells us what the pagan view of God is. It's that the world is God, that nature is the goddess. And then he talks about their spirituality, that they worship idols of various things within the created order. That's not primitive. That makes sense if indeed nature is divine. And then he comes to that third element. So it's theology, spirituality, and then sexuality, you see. I think it's important to say to any folks listening who may be homosexual or tempted by it, Paul is not picking on homosexuals because it's the worst possible sin. He's developing a worldview, and he's showing how that worldview is antithetical to the worldview of the Bible, and that, as June Singer says, homosexuality is a sacrament of that overturned worldview. That's why Paul deals with it. He's not a homophobe. He says many in the Christian church were indeed homosexuals, and the church is open to homosexuals who will turn away from that lifestyle. And so Paul doesn't say these are the worst sinners and we can't deal with them. He's simply giving us a clear view of what the pagan worldview is all about.
We're talking with Dr. Peter Jones. He is professor of New Testament at Westminster Seminary in Escondido, California. He directs Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet and has authored this new book, The God of Sex. We're talking about spirituality and sexuality here during this hour of Issues, etc. By the way, you can visit the website for Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet. It's CWIPP.org. Christian Witness to a Pagan Planet, CWIPP.org. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727. Or our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org, issuesetc@kfuo.org. It won't be too long now that at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, they will be celebrating a Christian vision of love and marriage with a retreat that they're holding there, September the 18th through the 20th, there on the campus of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. A great number of excellent speakers will be gathered for that several-day conference. They'll be talking not only about sex, but also about love, marriage, and family. All of these things go together. For more information on a Christian Vision for Love and Marriage conference at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, you can find the logo at our homepage, issuesetc.org, or you can call Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, area code 260-452-2204. Area code 260-452-2204. And again, our website address, issuesetc.org. When we come back from this break, he put the question off till the next section, so we'll pick it up when we come back. The differences are crucial. The created difference between male and female, it's where a Christian view of love and of sexuality begins. We'll talk about that after this with Peter Jones.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.